Do you or someone you love wish you had a better job? Want to be happier on your current job? Don't even have a job? Welcome to Work with Marty Nemko.
Silicon Valley. It's mystical to many, magical to others. Many people are curious about it. They see it as the source of big buck jobs. But what's it really like to work in Silicon Valley? I've got the right guy here. He's kind of a Silicon Valley anthropologist, if you will. His name is Mike Cassidy. He's been writing a column called Silicon Valley Dispatches for 4 years. And before that, he was one of the major chroniclers of the Valley's dot-com boom, dot-com bust. He's won a first-place award for column writing for the American Association of Sunday and Feature Editors, and he was a member of a team that won a Pulitzer Prize. Mike Cassidy, welcome to Work with Marty Nemko.
Thanks, Marty. It's my pleasure.
Good. Well, let's start with the question. Seems like everybody's endlessly curious about what's it really like to work at Google.
What's it like to work at Google? It is heaven on earth.
Really? No. Yeah.
It's a job. But it's a pretty amazing place. I mean, you probably have read about some of this stuff, but the perks, they bring you to work in a bus. They feed you for free. They give you a massage. You can get haircuts. I read a story this morning. They're building a new campus, and they're considering including a vineyard.
But isn't the reason they do all that because they want to keep you there? I mean, if you get having your lunch there, you're not going out and taking long lunches. If you're not having to waste time commuting, going away, if you're getting a haircut down there, I mean, isn't it just really a thinly veiled way to keep you working as much as possible?
Yes. Well, that's exactly it. I mean, it's what the bosses will say is it's a way for people to mingle and exchange ideas. But in truth, the joke is there are people at the Googleplex who haven't left in 10 years.
Right. And do they resent it? You know, that many in the media, you know, and many advocates of work-life balance would say, you know, that Silicon Valley culture as exemplified by Apple and Google, you know, that is workaholism at its worst. What about family? What about work-life balance?
Right.
When you have talked with the people who work there, is there a sense that they resent it, or they love their work enough and feel it's better than playing Monopoly with their kids?
Well, you know, it's no surprise that people are not necessarily forthcoming around this issue. So I don't know that I know the answer. But I've talked to people, and I don't want to sound patronizing, but I think some people don't realize the damage that's being done to them by this sort of crazy work schedule. They tend to be on the younger side, and they may not even have families to worry about.
Use the term damage. I will cop to my own bias. Because I've been a career counselor to over 4,000 people, I have a pretty good sample size of whom is most burned out, who is most energized. And, of course, there's always exceptions across the human condition. But in general, the people who are most content with their lives are those who are working the 12-hour days. They find it incredibly energizing to work on a project and having to stay up until 2 in the morning. They talk about time just passes, and then they see the software or the Google Glass or this cool thing. They're grateful to do that. There is exceptions, and I tend to see some exceptions because I'm a career counselor. The unhappy ones come to me. But do you really use the word damage? You think that's a fair term?
Well, you know, I guess words is my living. Maybe I should pick them more carefully. But what I was thinking more of was in terms of relationships. I take your point, and I think it's true. I mean, at Google, they're building a floating Wi-Fi hotspot. I mean, how would you like to be working on that? That would be thrilling. But, you know, I think you can wake up one morning and say, who is this man or woman I sleep with every night? Or what happened to – didn't we used to have little people running around here? What are they doing in college?
Really depends on priorities. You know, there are some people for whom family is everything. But there are many other people, and I will cop to being one among them. And, I've been married 40 years. I've got a daughter who's successful. But I profoundly believe that if you've got a great work life, the overall sense of your life's meaning does not centrally reside in family. If you have just an okay job or a less than okay job, then, of course, then your wife, your children become primary. But if you feel you are creating, even if it's a weight loss app, something that's going to help potentially thousands of people to lose weight, let alone working on making Wi-Fi available to millions of other people, mm-hmm. you feel cosmically that your life is more, it's a better use of your of work hours 40 to 60 of the week to be working on that than making a 3-hour healthy, locally grown, sustainable, organic dinner of pork, pork medallions in a
grass raised
vinaigrette. What do you really think about as you step out from your own self, but as you think about all the people over the years you've interviewed and talked with in Silicon Valley? To what extent is the view that I've just presented anomalous, and how much is more typical of them?
Well, here you are, Marty, right on the radio. You're persuading me, and your partner's doing a good job too here.
Yeah.
But when I think about it, I talked to Steve Kirsch recently. He's sort of a well-known Silicon Valley guy, and he started a ton of companies. He's starting one right now. A few years back, he was diagnosed with a form of cancer that's too hard for me to pronounce. But mm-hmm. I said, geez, isn't this a wake-up call? Don't you think you should be spending more time with your family, or questions along those lines? And his answer was, not really, because this is who I am.
Exactly.
This is why my family loves me. And he's doing well right now, by the way, I should say.
Good. And whether his family loved him or not every, there is this primacy in America that the family is number one. I think that one size does not fit all. For some people, family is number one. I do love the quote of Isaac Asimov, who had written 500 books, and he was asked, if you had 6 months to live, what would you do? And everybody expected a big vacation, more time with family, smell the roses. He said, I'd type faster.
Yeah. Well, that's about 500 more books than I've written. But, I think there's something to that. You have to, to your own self be true, blah, blah, blah. I guess part of me worries. Maybe I worry too much. But that's something that, theoretically could be taken advantage of by an employer.
If it depends, if everyone was forced to work 70 hours a week, it's one thing. But if somebody who considers work-life balance primary, wants to work 30 or 40 hours a week, working for Google is not the right place.
Right.
If we really celebrate diversity, there should be diversity of work options. Somebody who applies to a Silicon Valley top-flight company knows that there's going to be a corporate, it'll be a cultural expectation to work 50, 60 hours a week.
Yeah.
There are many places where the norm is not that. So why shouldn't we celebrate the diversity and be grateful that if there is an opportunity for somebody to work 60 hours a week? For example, I work 80 hours a week,
yeah,
and love it. And if I were not self-employed, I would be grateful to have a world of options where there were places where I could work 30 hours, or where they'd love it and expect for me to work 70 hours, especially since the results, even of some things that we think are as soulless, like a video chip.
Mm-hmm.
A video chip that simply enables the reds to look redder and the refresh rate to be faster, so in a game it looks like continuous full motion video. It seems soulless, but in the end helps millions of people mm-hmm. to better enjoy their lives. Should we denigrate somebody who stays up till 2 in the morning to try to make that happen, to beat the competition, their video chip comes out first and is better? Is that not, should we not, instead of labeling them, pathologizing them as workaholic, analogizing to alcoholic addicted to something bad, should we not call them simply hard workers or even heroes?
Well, maybe. I'll tell you what, maybe I should just come over and sit on your side of the table, because I'll go a little farther or broaden that a bit. And besides enriching other people's lives, consumer type people, that chip creates businesses. It might create an industry. It might create something that nobody had envisioned before.
And jobs.
Jobs.
Exactly.
And, one more thing. If you're working at Google and you don't like it, you've got some options. I mean, I don't want to stereotype, but people working at Google are at least brilliant. And so if they want to go do something else, chances are they can go do something else.
Speaking of the brilliant thing is very important. Are they really all brilliant? There is a stereotype and always there's exceptions. Is there anything that is not valid about the stereotype about Silicon Valley work life? Brilliant geeks working long hours, a no-nonsense meritocracy. It's the best man and woman gets, the job, and vigorous entrepreneurialism. Everybody's looking for a new business to start. That's the stereotype.
Yeah.
Is there anything inaccurate about that stereotype?
Well, I mean, I think that that's true, but not for all people. there are those. I mean, I guess that's how a stereotype happens, right? But I would think one of the biggest differences to that scenario would be the meritocracy. Yeah, maybe to an extent. But I think for certain people who are, say, 50 years old or older, there's research, actually, that shows in terms of pay, if you're white or Asian in Silicon Valley, your pay has been increasing over the last few years. If you're black or Latino, your pay has been decreasing.
To what extent is, you know, one could say that that's, you know, rampant evidence of rampant racism and sexism, et cetera. And to what extent could that be, whether it be age or whatever, that on average, for reasons that go beyond the scope of this show, that as the demands of being excellent get ever ratcheted higher, as the competition gets ever greater, that there are more whites or Asians who have the skill set or the ability to perform at that extremely high level, and you know, you could say, and that that's causal rather than that there are these cabal of white males who are sitting in a room saying, "I think we're going to pay minorities less this year. We paid them more in the past, but we're going to really screw them now."
No, I would think it's something in between all that, but I don't have the research. But I think, you know, people tend to hire people like themselves. There tends to be sort of this, what do they call it, unconscious bias. You tend to fund companies like companies you've funded before. So I don't think it's a cabal by any means, and I don't have the background or the research to know all else that goes into it. I just know what the numbers are.
Let's and that's always very dangerous to look at numbers. Correlation and causation are not the same.
Numbers are pretty helpful.
It's very dangerous to simply look, for example, if we look that there, you know, you brought up race. So we look at the National Basketball Association, and certainly there over 90% of the people in the NBA are black. Should we therefore say that there is racism and we need to have, you know, we need to have redress for the old Asian women who are not represented and who are underrepresented in the NBA? But let's not go there because it's a complicated topic. You're listening to Work with Marty Nemko, and I'm talking with Mike Cassidy. He is a Silicon Valley columnist. He writes the Silicon Valley Dispatches column for the Mercury News. And we're talking about what work life is really like in Silicon Valley. Let's turn to, you mentioned jobs. Well, let's talk about Steve Jobs for a minute.
Oh, yeah.
He often talked about the importance of hiring nothing but A players,
right?
But not everybody is an A player. Most people are, you know, are not by definition. Mm-hmm. You know, and unlike in the Garrison Keillor world where everybody's above average, the reality is we all aren't. Are there good careers in the Valley for people who are not high-powered A player techies?
You know, I think so. Maybe I'm the eternal optimist, but you know, there's job growth in, and you probably want A players here too, but there are job growth in the Valley in education fields, in healthcare, like there is across the country. But also manufacturing has been showing some real life in the Valley. And that, you know, that is the kind of career that has a whole range of skill sets. And I think, you know, everything from a machinist, which is, you know, not easy to become, but it's a different skill set from, say, a computer programmer, from a machinist to a supply chain logistics expert. You know, it's a wide range. And so I think there are jobs, and even in companies, maybe even in Apple, although Jobs always said, you know, if you allow B players to come in, you attract C players. And
yep,
he thought of B players stood for bozos, I think. But
yeah, that's what he called them.
But, you know, there are support jobs that are needed. I mean, there are, you know, I don't want to sound like Garrison Keillor, but there are things you can be good at. And maybe that's the challenge, is figuring that out.
Okay. Let me ask about this instead. Let's talk about bring it more concrete rather than in theory. You've got two kids.
Yeah.
You got a kid in college. You got a junior in high school.
Correct.
Maybe they are A-plus players. Maybe they are the future Steve Jobs and Sergey Brin. Maybe not. Would you be willing to tell me honestly what you tell your kids about career stuff and about and careers in Silicon Valley, because you spend so much time in it?
Well, very honestly, what I tell them is find a career that will allow you to support your father in his old age. But maybe you're looking for something a little more serious. And by the way, they are both A-plus players. They're brilliant. But neither of them really show any interest in programming or technical fields, technology fields. And so what I tell them, honestly, is not that brilliant. I tell them, you know, follow your passion. And the reason I say that is, you know, you're going to be doing something. You work 80 hours a week. You know, whatever it is, you better like it. But beyond that, I think there's an important caveat that I also talk to them about, which is, be ready for the unexpected. Watch for something you never knew you liked, because you're going to be doing, you know, 6, 7, 8 different jobs in your career, maybe 6, 7, 8 different careers. Yeah. So you have to be ready to change.
Yeah, I don't know if you saw me, my face dropped when I heard the follow your passion thing.
Yeah, I did.
It's a real canard. And I've talked about this on the radio a few weeks ago, actually. If you follow your passion, most people's passions lie in a very small number of areas, mm-hmm. you know, the environment, entertainment, fashion, whatever. Because of that, supply and demand means that there's going to be 10,000 people applying. For example, a lot of people are passionate about journalism.
Right.
So if you go and you follow your passion to be a journalist, you know, do what you love and probably poverty will follow. So unless your passion is somewhat anomalous, it's very risky to follow your passion for what your career is. What I recommend people realize is that all work is worthy work, and to be passionate about being productive is the key. And so whether you are somebody who manufactures microphones or distributes shirts or is an administrative assistant or a techie, if you realize that all work is really so important, it is critical to the life well led. If you can imbue that in your children and in yourself, you'll be less likely to need to, quote, follow your passion. And then when you're on the job, if you say to yourself, I'm going to become the go-to guy or go-to girl at whatever it is you're doing, eyeglass fabrication, being a race timer for college events, mm-hmm. and you decide you're going to become the go-to guy or go-to girl, that is a far more likely path to career contentment than the standard phrase, follow your passion, because there are millions of people who are in fields that are ostensibly the cool careers who are miserable. How many actors and how many performers commit suicide or have drug addiction problems or whatever? Normally, career contentment has very little to do with being in a cool, passionate industry. It's much more within you and in your attitude toward the concept of productivity. Does that make any sense?
Well, that makes some sense. But I got to tell you, Marty, I've kind of ceded the high ground here. I mean, look what I did. I came out of college. In college, I was interested in getting a newspaper job. At the time, at least there were jobs. But what I was told was, you're taking a vow of poverty. You know, you're going to be poor. That did not turn out to be the case. But nonetheless, I did it because that's what I wanted to do. So now I got to tell my kids, don't be like me. You know, don't make the mistakes I made. So anyway, it's just an aside.
Well, you remember you wanted to be a journalist in an era when the journalist was still getting paid.
Right.
Imagine I was your son.
Yeah.
And I came to you and said, Daddy, I want to be just like you. I want to be a columnist at the Mercury News, and I want to get paid good money and benefits and a salary and all of that. Because I want to follow my passion.
Right.
What would you say to me?
Well, true story. My older daughter, when she was a freshman in high school, one of her electives was music. She played the flute. She came and said, I want to drop that and I'm going to take journalism next year. And I said, honey, you'd be a lot better sticking with that flute and getting a tin cup and standing on the corner. You'll make a lot more money.
Yeah, alas.
So I would have to be somewhat discouraging. I mean, I think those are fine skills to have, to be able to talk to people, ask them questions, to be able to write, to be able to put together a sentence that people can understand. But traditional journalism might not be the way to exercise those skills.
And that's why it's critical that the follow your passion thing needs to be very tempered by, you know, reality. I mean, how many career counselors have told people to follow their passions, and their clients follow their passions, and whether it be music or art or any of these things or the environment? You know, I can't get past this client who was one of my earliest clients. She She was a true one of the earliest environmentalists, and not stupid and not lazy. Mm-hmm. And so she was the first one to be an activist against lead paints, and you know, and she built straw bale houses, and she wrote a book even. And she's now 60-something with high blood pressure and, and living in welfare housing and broke, dead broke. And she said, what is this about do what you love and the money will follow? What is this about you follow your passion?
You know, I had my caveat, you know, be open to new things and keep your eyes open.
Let's turn to something else here. Let's talk about growth. Let's have some success stories here. It's important. Part of the stereotype about work in Silicon Valley is that you know, whether you're an immigrant or you're not, you know, millions of many mm-hmm. immigrants have come to the Valley. They were smart. They were hardworking and they were tech savvy and they started businesses and they went from poverty to wealth.
Right.
How legitimate is that narrative?
Well, you got me thinking a lot about that. I mean, it is certainly true in a number of cases that you can point to. I mean, one of my all-time favorite Silicon Valley success stories is a guy named Trung Young, who left Vietnam when he was 17 years old, got into an overloaded fishing boat, you know, of refugees. The boat crashed, and he ended up in a refugee camp in Malaysia for a year or something. Comes to Boston, gets a GED, enrolls at UMass, is a brilliant technologist, comes up with a company idea, comes out to the Valley. I mean, when he's in his mid-30s, the thing goes public, and one day he's worth $80 million. You know, that's the story you hear, and those are sometimes true stories.
How rare? Are we a lot of failure? You know,
yeah.
Are you in a position to assess how often that narrative is accurate and how often people try to do that? And like going to Hollywood, you know, there's the ones who make it onto Oprah, they're always talking about their success story and follow your passion. But then there are the millions who never get on Oprah who came to Hollywood and failed. Do you have any idea how likely, if I'm a bright person who's willing to work hard and I'm kind of tech savvy and I come to the Valley from, you know, from Vietnam or from Podunk, Iowa, you know, is it... Are we long past the days of the garage-based entrepreneur? Is that an old, quaint, historical truth, and is that realistic anymore?
Well, Marty, you got me thinking about that a lot, which is good, about failure and about, you know, all the talk in Silicon Valley, the legend even, is that the Valley's built on failure. You fail, you learn, you succeed. But, you know, it's a lot easier to find the success stories than to find the failure stories. People may fail, but then their story kind of goes away. But exactly. Real quickly to answer your question, I think the garage thing, I think it's still possible, but it comes out in different forms now. And, you know, app builders, which can sometimes be just ridiculous things, but these people are doing it in their spare bedroom and, you know, some of them are succeeding.
Yeah. Again, when I first started out as a career counselor, I was much more optimistic. Now mm-hmm. I look at the fact, for example, you talk about app builders. There are millions of apps, and many people are willing to give them away for free. And they're not one person anymore. Now apps are being built by 20. It's really app is just a fancy word for software.
I'm not giving career advice. I'm just saying it is happening.
It's happening. The question is statistics. The question is the odds.
Yeah, no.
You know, if I were tech savvy and I wanted to create an app for anything, you know. For exercise tracking or whatever.
Right.
There's already probably a zillion apps out there. And unlike in the old days before the internet, right now, finding the best app with the highest user ratings and critic ratings is a Google search away. Mm. I can find the best. Mm-hmm. So how in the world can I have the hubris to think that I'm going to develop a great exercise app when Nike has invested millions in exercise apps and all the rest of them? I'm competing with 7 billion people on the planet.
Right.
And, you know, and anybody, any jerk can find out who's the best and probably get it for free. How am I going to make my living developing this app? It's feeling like that's an old narrative. It doesn't feel realistic anymore unless I'm working for a Nike or a Google, where my branding and my marketing power and the fact that Google or Nike can assemble a 50-person team and put $5 million into an app development. Is app development just a quaint anachronism?
I'm not sure. But I mean, forget apps. And it's not I don't know if it's changed that much. Just think about startups. The common statistic, which maybe it's apocryphal, I don't know, but the common statistic is that 9 out of 10 startups fail.
Right.
And that's been bantied about for 20 years.
Right.
So that's not new. And I think it definitely is the exception. But there are some exceptional exceptions. People, you know, the kid in England who built that news aggregating app that Yahoo bought. I mean, that's another way to do it. The Tumblr guys, you know, Yahoo buys it for $1 billion. But, you know, so I don't know. Should you go out and say, well, I'm going to become wealthy or support myself by building apps? I don't know, but should you sit in the corner and rock? That's probably not such a good idea either.
No, I think there's a middle ground, and yeah. I think it's more nuanced. I think it depends on the person. I think you need to realize that this is a mature industry. High tech is no longer a new industry. It's a
True.
Mature industry. And in a mature industry, only the strong survive, the strongest survive. So if you are brilliant and driven, if it was my client or, you know, my son or daughter, if you are brilliant and you are driven, I would probably not try to go it alone. I think we live in it. It's just too hard to try to develop mm-hmm. and let alone market this thing on your own. I would try to create an app that I would not use to sell, but I would use it to sell myself.
Right.
I would use that to send to the Googles and the Apples of the world and say, this is the kind of work I can create on my own.
Right.
I am aware that in today's world, it requires more than what one person can do. As they say, it takes a team, a mm-hmm. village or mm-hmm. whatever. Mm-hmm. And I would use that to get hired by a brand name company and then try to use my mojo that way rather than start a business.
Well, that kind of thing is going on. Now, I've done very little reporting on this, so I'll give you the broad outline. But there is an outfit in Palo Alto that does summer internships in which they bring in presumably high school and college kids to build apps. And the idea is, you know, just what you're saying, the folks who run this say the app is the new resume. I mean,
good
building
point.
An app
That's
is your
a nice
resume.
Phrase. The app is the new resume. Ladies and gentlemen, that is, you know, let's broaden from that. It's your work sample that is your new resume. You have two things that can get you or not get you a job. The result of your Google search,
yeah.
because that's what everybody cares. It's not your resume. Resume is a BS document that you just create yourself, and everybody knows this, unfortunately, in this dishonest society.
Yeah. It's gone from a CV to a BS, huh?
Right, exactly. Exactly. So it's, you know, doing what you can to have your Google search results reflect who you are. And so if there's, for example, an anomalous criticism of you, respond to it, talk to the person who wrote it, see if you can get mm-hmm. it excised, and then creating a work sample. If you're a teacher, it's creating a video of your teaching. If you are a project manager, it is a documentation of all the steps you took to handle a difficult huh. project. If you're an app developer or a software junkie, forget about C++. Those days are yeah. over. It's Python. Mm-hmm. It's Ruby. It's Hadoop. It's that showing, creating a sample in those languages and sending it. And again, we live in an era of consolidation. The small startups, yes, some of them make it, but statistically, you have a much better chance of making it working for an Amazon or an Apple or a Google. Send your work sample to them. That's my best career advice. I see you nodding. You agree?
Well, I'm just thinking it must be amazing the way the advice you give people has changed through your career.
Tremendously. Oh, my God, yes. I've been doing this 24 years. Everything I said now would be very different 10 years ago. And because I'm getting older. We talked about mm-hmm. people over 50. Mm-hmm. I'm over 50. And if you need to use your fear of ageism mm-hmm. as the fuel to make you say it is triply important that you be really up to speed on whatever it is you need to be up to speed on. My wife as well. My wife is over 50 also, and she's a superintendent of schools. And she decided after 50, she was going to make educational technology the centerpiece of her expertise.
Oh, interesting.
And so she has focused her butt off on becoming the queen of technology, and she's now on the state's the state superintendent's technology committee. She speaks all over the country.
Terrific.
So especially if you're over 50, that is, instead of seeding, to use your word, C-E-D-I-N-G, instead of seeding the technology space mm-hmm. to the 20-somethings, the, quote, digital natives, fight against the good fight. Do not go gently into the good night.
Uh-huh. Rage against the kids.
Rage against the kids. I like it. Okay. Let's end with one more question here. A little more. Let's go controversial.
Oh, good.
Silicon Valley is right now, as comprehensive immigration reform is being discussed, mm-hmm. The corporations in Silicon Valley, the Facebooks, the Apples, the Googles, are arguing that they need to increase the number of H-1B visas. People who are predominantly from Asia, who are highly skilled, because mm-hmm. They say that Americans They don't say this overtly, but the real statement is that Asians will work harder. They have a greater cultural tradition of technology work, and because the law for H-1B requires them to be paid the same, it's not because we want to get them paid cheaper.
Right.
But the opponents say that it's unfair to Americans. It's, you know, et cetera. From where you sit, what's the real story about the legitimacy of Silicon Valley companies like Google and Apple asking for more H-1B visas so they can hire more immigrants?
Well, this might not be a real satisfying answer, but I think it's a huge fog. It's like a lot of these very controversial issues. You can find statistics and figures to support almost whatever you want. But what, as it turns out, most of the H-1B, the top 10 companies on the list of H-1B holders, they're all outsourcing companies. So it has really nothing to do with, I mean, right now, the current situation has nothing to do with the Googles and the Apples and what they want.
It's the Wipros and the Infosys.
Exactly. Exactly right. And that's messed up, to use a technical term.
Why is that messed up? If I am a company who specializes in helping American companies, like I'm essentially, I get Google contracts with me to create, say, a call center in India.
Right.
And in order for certain legal requirements to be met, I need H-1B visas for some of those Wipro people. Why is that messed up?
Well, I believe at least the scenario is what happens is the H-1Bs from Wipro come here and work, learn the job, and then take it back to India.
Why is that messed up?
Well, because I don't like it. I think that's a flaw with the system. That's not how the H-1B system is presented.
What would be so, what, what's
so all, what's messed up is that that what those in favor of it say is happening is not happening. But now, on the other hand, I'm not necessarily anti-H-1B visa. I think, and there is talk, I don't know what the latest version of the immigration bill is, but there's talk about some very sensible reforms that would make the system a better system in my eyes.
Like what?
Well, some have talked about why give the H-1B to the company? Why not have it go directly to the employee? And that way you sort of lose that kind of sense of indentured servitude. And perhaps that relieves some of the downward pressure on pay. If you're marketable, that should make, theoretically that should make pay more competitive.
One more question. This is something I have also said on the radio. I feel as much care. I care as much about a worker in more. I care more about a worker in Bangalore in Mumbai as I do in someone in Bakersfield, because without the American companies, H-1B, you know, pricing, you know, if I'm living in Mumbai, it's the holy grail for me to work for Wipro.
Yeah.
And then indirectly for Amazon or whatever, because I'm going to make, you know, otherwise I could be making, $10 a day.
Right.
I work for Wipro and I'm going to make, $100 a day or $200 a day. Yeah. It changes my life from utter dire poverty to a much more sustainable lifestyle, whereas the person in Bakersfield is not going to be as destitute. Why shouldn't I be thrilled that some of these workers in India are going to be therefore benefiting, even if somebody in Bakersfield doesn't?
Well, I think that's a legitimate point, but why can't Wipro pay them in India to do the work?
Because of American laws that require, for American company, they have to have for a certain percentage of jobs. The federal government says that they have to be American, have visas. That's, if it weren't for the government regulations, they would be just hire someone in India, but the government doesn't allow that in America.
But I mean, if you're working for Google or for Wipro in India, you don't need a visa. I mean, if you live in India and work in India, you're fine.
Now you're beyond my, frankly, that's beyond my knowledge
base. Well, okay.
Let's end with a softball question. If there was one other thing you wanted to let our listeners know about what it's like to work in Silicon Valley or how to get a good job in Silicon Valley that we haven't yet discussed, what's the one more thing you'd want to tell our listeners?
Well, I'd end on an optimistic note.
Great.
I think the Valley is still an economic engine and that it requires a broad array of people to do the work. There are the technology jobs, and that's sort of at the top of the food chain. But all those people need support, and all those companies need the supporting infrastructure to get done what they're doing. And I think many of those companies are destined to be a big presence in the Valley for a long time. Whether they're obviously global companies, but they're going to have a strong presence in the Valley for a long time to come.
And I hope that you have your Silicon Valley Dispatches column for a long time to come. My guest has been Mike Cassidy. He does write the Silicon Valley Dispatches column for the Mercury News, and I do commend it to you. Mike, thanks very much for being my guest on Work with Marty Nemco.
Thanks for having me.
All right. Now we turn to you, my dear listeners. If you have a question about your work life, any aspect, whether you are a Silicon Valley employee or not, or if you're a Silicon Valley employer or not, but if you are stuck, that's the operative word. If you have a career conundrum, you or someone you love, whether you're a clerk or you're a CEO, whether you're a techie or a tech phobe, I usually can help you at least take a baby step forward. The phone number here for what I call a 3-minute workover, of course, I do not pummel you. The phone number here at Work with Marty Nemco, 415-841-4134. That's 415-841-4134. And while waiting for your calls, I have these various musings and ideas that I have been coming up with over time and that I wanted to share with you. We were, in a sense, talking, you know, there was a fair amount of, worry, maybe even pessimism in my previous interview. But I think there's a larger truth that is a legitimate basis for optimism, at least as an umbrella for how we view our work life, indeed society. There are 7 billion people on the planet, and we're all, in our own different ways, trying to make things better. How can one not be an optimist about the world's future? Because most, out of the 7 billion people, most people, nobody's trying to make it worse. You know, we may not agree with their way to make it better, but there are 7 billion people trying to make things better. So does not, even at our points of despondency and whatever, does that not give us at least a little hope that in the end things will be better? I think it's President Obama who has his, somewhere in his office, he's got something like, you know, there may be ups and downs, but in the end things are inexorably better. That's something that I kind of agree with and just wanted to share with you. Before I go to the phones, one more. It's almost a cliche that in the area of communication, we need to tell stories. While really brilliant people are not swayed by anecdote, they realize that anecdote is merely a sample of one and that they'd rather rely on data. Most people are swayed much more by story and by emotion than they are by data. But I think that's a little not subtle. That's not subtle enough. We are moved somewhat more by story, but we are moved more by what I call the story, the archetypal story. When you're giving a talk or you're structuring something you're writing, there are really only about 4 or 5 archetypal stories. These are the stories that Joseph Campbell talked about when he wrote about in Myth. The ultimate story is something called the quest. Everybody likes, and you watch it in every movie, whether it be the Rings trilogy or it be Rocky or whatever, there's always the archetypal quest. Somebody, usually the average schnook or somebody who's had a lot of failings in life, has an epiphany moment where he realizes or she realizes there is a goal, a big goal that he or she wants. And then the story is the travails, the ups and downs, usually the rising set of conflicts that lead to eventually the big final moment where he or she is fighting the antagonist and in the end wins or loses. If you, instead of just telling a story or an anecdote, if you frame what you're doing in terms of an archetypal story such as the quest, you will more likely move people to attitude change and perhaps behavior change. That's, I want to briefly talk about the other archetypal stories. And in fact, I think I don't want my callers to wait on the lines too long. So I will tell more about those archetypal stories in a moment. But let's go to the phone. Let me give out the phone number again. If you or someone you love has a work-life problem, you are stuck, a career conundrum, I usually can help you take at least a baby step forward. The phone number here at Work with Marty Nemco for a 3-minute workover, 415-841-4134. That's 415-841-4134. And now to the phones. It is your turn on the air. How can I help? Hello.
Hi, am I on the air?
You are.
Hi, this is Ohosion from San Francisco. I love your show, and I've called in before.
I'm glad to have you back.
Yeah, love Joseph Campbell and Carl Jung. In fact, Ohosion is a name from a dream I had. So let's hear it for archetypes.
Okay.
I'm down with it.
You're down with archetypes. I'm not sure Joseph Campbell would.
I'm also down against. I'm down with Rage Against the Kids. That's cool. Anyway, in 1967, I wrote in my high school annual, "Let's Talk Ancient History." I'm going to be either an artist or a teacher. Mm-hmm. Guess what? I became both.
Very good.
I assigned myself this life. Mm-hmm. And I'm now fully, and have been always, I should just come right out and go, I've always been an independent contractor. So this links up with your last guest a little bit. I was a massage therapist in a very popular spa. Garrison Keillor actually booked an appointment with us.
Was he above average?
I wasn't there, but I would consider him well above average.
Okay, yeah, me too.
And I dip into the low average, below average, above average, way above average. I don't care, mm-hmm. as long as it's for the good, okay? Or the quote good.
And massage is in its small way for the good, without question.
Oh, major. So we were doing our work on dot-commerce during the dot-com boom. Mm-hmm. I'm talking about wounded animals who walked into our place who never worked 18 hours a day in their lives. And the amount of lumpage in their bodies was astounding.
Lumpage?
Lumpage. I mean, you can actually feel the knots all up and down their spine, in the back of their legs, in their arms, their hands, by their ears, because they're on earphones all day, you know. So I've been there, done that, and you know what? I miss it. I miss it. I'm not working for anybody again, but I'm writing, okay? Which is a slow process in the hello.
You there?
That's the word, when you put something off.
Procrastinate.
Putting it off.
Procrastinate.
I'm not putting it off so much as my health and a big Toyota Tacoma took me out, okay, and tried to take me out. So I'm living post-epiphanal, if you follow me, and I'm 63, and it ain't over.
So how can I help?
Pardon me?
Do you have a question, or are you just kind of making an affirmation that it ain't over?
It ain't over.
All right.
And I'm still a kid. So, you know, rage against me, and I'll ask the kids what committees they've served on.
One thing I'm going to suggest, I always like to leave with something which you can accept or reject as you will. Okay. As I always try to think of ways to make your age a plus so that, you know, it may be that if somebody's 20-something, they would prefer to have a massage therapist who's 20-something or 30-something, they may think of. But especially as we get older and our bodies are not quite as, youthful as they were, perhaps you might specialize, if you feel like you still like doing massage work, not only necessarily in massaging older people, but now from a spiritual point of view. People, when they get certain diseases, including cancer, massage can be very helpful, at least in reducing pain or whatever. I'm wondering, you know, because older people do get sick more often with serious illnesses, I'm wondering if you might redirect, do a small pivot of your massage therapy, which would get you more work, in focusing on people who are older and perhaps even people who have a medical need for massage. How does that feel to you?
I'm laughing because my body is so torn up. I'm having to accept massage now.
I see.
Receiving it, and it's great. And I accept that I'm a writer, and that here we go back to hiring practices. Two of my best law firms who supported me were ethnically diverse, and I'm going to leave you with that. Thank you so much.
Okay, you take care. She talks about hiring practices. So first, let me give you the phone number. If you would like some career advice, if you are career stuck, that's kind of my mission in life, is to help people get unstuck. Phone number here at Work with Marty Nemko for a 3-minute workover, 415-841-4134. That's 415-841-4134. I promised you before I took the call that I would share some more of the archetypal stories. And the reason we're talking about archetypal stories is, for better or worse, we tend to be persuaded in the workplace and outside by story more than data. And so the effective communicator, even a data-driven one, needs to master the art of storytelling. And key to that is not so much just telling a story, but there's more power, more likelihood of creating transformational change in the behavior of a listener if you use an archetypal story. And the first example I gave was of the quest, but there are others. They're stranger in a strange land. There is a natural feeling, especially for those who are not the most successful, to rally behind the underdog. And one of the ways in which an underdog can be portrayed is as a stranger in a strange land. So if you're telling the story about being in a new environment, if you're a farm boy who ended up coming to Silicon Valley, if you are somebody who decided in his desire for a spiritual quest to, you know, go to try to see the guru in the Himalayas and your travails, that is an archetypal story, stranger in a strange land, that can be very compelling to people. Rags to riches is another archetypal story. It is kind of the quintessential Horatio Alger American capitalist narrative. People still, because we do live in we're not a capitalist country anymore, we're a mixed economy for sure, but still there are many people who believe in the rags to riches narrative and want to. And so that's why I asked my guest, Mike Cassidy, before about stories, the poor immigrant who came to this country, told about the Vietnamese guy and came and, you know, made millions of dollars. People love to hear rags to riches stories because it gives them hope. It's kind of like the lottery idea. We all know that most people don't buy a lottery ticket, don't win the lottery, but we buy because it gives us hope. So rags to riches is an archetypal story that is based on the notion of hope. Then another archetypal story is revenge. When something bad has happened to you, and you can, if you start your story by talking, really making clear that you legitimately were treated very unfairly relative to your merit, and then, you know, how you went and exerted revenge, that for some audiences, that tends to work for certain audiences and not for others, but it is an archetypal story that can often be a useful tool. And finally, the boy meets girl story. We all like the idea that you know, while we recognize intellectually that most marriages, or, you know, more than half of marriages end up in divorce, and a lot of them that don't are still unhappy, we like to still believe that true romantic love and passion and living life forever after is possible. And of course, in today's gender fair environment, it's not just boy meet girl. It could be boy meet boy, girl meet girl. Whatever, but the idea of the story of finding true love can even be extended beyond people to people, finding true love in your career. Those are all useful archetypal stories that can help you be more persuasive in the workplace and without. Not just storytelling, go beyond that. See if you can kind of craft your story to fit one of the core archetypes. And so now let's go to the phones. Welcome to Work with Marty Nemko. It's your turn on the air. How can I help?
Yes, good morning.
Hi.
Hello.
Hi.
Yes, I'm an architect. I have been doing architecture in the Bay Area for the last 30 somewhat years. Mm. And the way that the job market is, it's a very high unemployment rate and in that field. I'm wondering that, you know, whether I want to do this after, you know, my 60th birthday coming up.
Right.
And I've been doing construction management and the construction of the houses, but I don't know exactly where to turn.
Okay.
Any ideas?
Yes. Let's do two things. I'm going to give you a quick incremental suggestion and then we're going to try to come up with something radically new that will be fun for you and different. But the incremental thing is it kind of dovetails on the fact that we talked about earlier, using your age to your advantage. As the boomers are aging, many of them are wanting to age in place, or their parents are wanting to age in place. So retrofitting someone's home, because your specialty is in construction, retrofitting homes to accommodate somebody who's no longer fully ambulatory, or creating in-law units. Many boomers are having their parents live with them because they can no longer live alone, and yet paying for an assisted living facility is out of the question. So perhaps redirecting your residential architecture expertise to repurposing people's homes to accommodate in-law is my little incremental suggestion. It's not a major pivot at all. I'm just curious what your reaction to that is.
Yes, actually, I did exactly the same thing to my house. I turned the basement into a studio that had to put the fire separation between the two units for the fire department to a lot has happened, and exactly the same thing happened. He was able to pull a permit from the city and turn it into a two-unit building.
Right.
That actually sounds very good.
Okay.
I just did one.
Okay.
And it makes sense, the retrofitting. The other idea that I had was basically...
Before we go to the... I want to hear your other idea in a minute, but you're way ahead of the game then, so you now have a sample. If by any chance you have photos of the place before the change, and you could take photos now and post that on your website and or use that as an example of the kind of retrofitting you could do, that will make it a lot easier for you to market that kind of a architectural practice. Make sense?
Absolutely. Absolutely. Do you have a building that I can do it for you?
I am very fortunate that I do not have that need, but I'm sure that there are many, many others who would.
Okay.
Right? So tell me about your other idea, and then I want to tell you.
My other idea was to get into construction of units that would have provide services. Like there would be a three-unit building that would have a concierge service that would basically, you would have more elderly people there that they don't want to go into elderly housing. But here you would do grocery for them, you would do their laundry, you would do other services. But it's a building that has a concierge, has a very high end service that provides to the tenants in that building.
That doesn't feel architectural. It feels like it doesn't utilize your architectural skills. Is there a way to construct? My first two reactions is, if there are ways to construct it so that there are common areas, common eating areas, common whatever, or something that would facilitate it. Be able to retain their independence and still share some common spaces. And then if you use the government, right now we are in an era that is moving very leftward, and it is very, very hard for independent entrepreneurs to make it on their own. But if you can create a partnership with government, for example, to say you want to create one as a model, as a pilot project to see if, you know, how whether this would work, and get some money from the government, maybe even some permit easings. We all know the cost of permitting is monumental. But if it's a joint project with the government, you may be able to at least build your first one, not just on your own dime. What's your reaction to that?
I totally agree. It's a lot of money at risk that if it doesn't fly, it would be devastating. But your first idea, I'm ready to run with that. I mean, I'm just so happy that I called you.
I'm glad. Well, that's my privilege to be doing this work. I'll be starting my 25th year doing the show October 1st, and so I've been doing this a long time, and it's a privilege to be doing it. So I thank you for the call. I'm not going to try to do it. We don't need a radical idea, because you're happy with one. I'll quit while I'm ahead. Thanks for the call. Let's go back to the phones. Welcome to Work with Marty Nemko. It's your turn on the air. How can I help? Hello, it's you.
Hello?
Yes, hi.
Hi, my name is Chris. I really enjoy your show. I listen whenever I can.
Thank you.
I'm 62 years old, and I just started a job. I really love the job. I was 2.5 years out of work, and to me, it's just an amazing miracle that I even got the job.
How'd you get to? Well, that's always interesting for our listeners. I do like to have positive stories where I can. Tell us the story. What were you doing before 2.5 years ago? What did you do to get this job, and what are you doing now?
2.5 years ago, I had been working nearly 12 years for a software company in support and training. I was hired into that company because of my background in the printing industry. I did not have a college degree, and at that time, the work market was so hot that people would take just about anybody. So I answered an ad to take this software training and support position based on my printing background.
Mm-hmm.
And that was fine. And then in February of, I think it was 2008, I was laid off. And it was a long time before I was able to find other work.
Mm-hmm. What did you do? What was it really like? If the goddess were looking down upon Chris during that time, how much time did you really work very hard to land a job? For how long? Did you not? What did you try? What didn't work? And then what ended up working?
Okay, here's what happened. I couldn't find work, but I never stopped trying to look for work, sending out resumes, answering any kind of ad that even remotely resembled what I was doing, and then also things that weren't. So I did things like I opened a room in my home to operate an Airbnb. I cleaned people's apartments as an Airbnb apartment cleaner. I drove instant cab for my, used my own vehicle as an instant taxi. I did some, I tried to start a content writing business. I did quite well with that. I did some work as a marketing assistant. So I just did a lot of different things.
But just so the people don't know, by the way, in case you don't know what Airbnb is, it's really kind of like a place where if you have some extra space to rent, whether it be residential or commercial, and you want to rent it out on a temporary basis, you put it on the Airbnb site and they make money, and they, Airbnb does hire some cleaning services to do cleaning. Anyway, please continue.
So I feel that, you know, it was divine intervention that I even got this job. I saw the ad on Craigslist. I fired off a cover letter and a resume. I got an interview. I had about 20 questions for the interviewer, and then they called me back, and he came out from the East Coast to interview me and probably several other people as well, and I was shocked to find out that I was hired. So, you know, I'm very, very grateful, but, you know, there's always a but, and I'm adjusting to a new work environment where most of the people are in their 30s, and I'm 62.
Yes.
So there's only one person there that I have a little bit of difficulty with, and that is that whenever I speak to him, he pretty much looks into space and ignores me. He hardly ever responds. So, you know, I can't get inside his head and figure out what the reason is for that. I'd just like to know a healthy way to deal with that, because we're all part of a team and we work very closely together. So that's my one question.
Love it. Great question. Sometimes, but not always. First of all, do you know if he interacts with everybody the same way? You mentioned age. Do you think he's dismissing you for your age? Do you think he acts this way with everybody? Is it something he doesn't like about you that has nothing to do with age? Do you have any idea?
I don't. Well, he doesn't interact this way with everybody. They're all his age, and they seem to be friendly, on friendly terms with one another, and they've all been there longer than I, of course. So.
Okay. So my next question is, sometimes it is wise and sometimes it isn't wise to go and say something like the following to him. Ask him out for coffee or meet him in the break room. And
right.
So, what's his first name?
I'm going to give you a fake name. His name
That's
is George.
George, great. So, George, I'm actually, I'm in role play now. This is what I would say. George, I'm actually feeling even a little awkward about doing this. You know, I really am grateful to be working here. I love being part of the team. And you're an important part of the team, and I feel like we're not clicking. I'm not blaming him for not paying attention. We're not clicking real well. Is there something that I need to do differently so that we can relate better? Put it all on you. He may say, no, everything is fine. You will have quietly put him on notice that he's been vegging out without it all being confrontational. Have you done that, and or should you do that?
No, and that's exactly what I thought of doing. I was going to say, George, let's take a walk, you know, and just, Maybe not as confrontational as I had in mind, but,
right.
You know, your way is a little bit more, shall we say, pleasant. So
tactful.
I think your way, I would definitely try that. That's exactly what I had in mind, but being there only 3 months, I didn't know if it was a matter of just giving it time or just,
Deal with it. It's always, especially in California, direct confrontation doesn't work well. We want to be face-saving. We say that Asians care about face-saving. We in America care about face-saving, too. Allow him to save face. Do not blame him. And I think it'll work out fine. Congratulations on having gotten the job. And may you keep it and enjoy it for a long time. Thanks for calling,
Chris.
You're welcome.
Bye-bye.
And that is Work with Marty Nemco for this week. I want to thank my board operator, Joan Marr, my guest, Mike Cassidy. Do read his Silicon Valley Dispatches column. Very worthwhile. And, of course, I thank most of all you for listening and calling in. Please join me again next Sunday at 11. My pile of career tips and musings that I just have to share with you is getting way too thick. So I'm going to be thinning the pile for you. Plus, as usual, you can call in for a three-minute workover. Until next Sunday, this is Marty Nemco reminding you that we find comfort among those who agree with us. Growth among those who don't.